Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah.
Kia ora, listeners. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, Alison. You're looking quite bad boy today with that blue jeans jacket.
Yes, with my collar turned up. Yeah. So,
is there a reason for that?
Well, there is, actually, Karen. You know, during our last show that we did about literary power couples, and when we were describing the Romantic era power couple, the Shelleys, I thought that it was quite a pity that we couldn't talk more about their friend Byron, with that famous description, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. But he wasn't really part of a power couple. He was more of a womaniser, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, and do you think, would he be the Romantic era's equivalent of a bad boy?
Yes, it was, you took the words out of my mouth. Absolutely, yeah. You know, he was flamboyant, that thing of swimming the Hellespont. I don't know if everyone knows, the Hellespont being the straits between Greece and Turkey. Is that right? Turkey and Europe? Where's the Hellespont? Anyway, in Greece and Turkey area. Notorious, narcissistic, reckless, you know, that impetuously heading off to Greece to fight for Greek independence, and a bit of touch of tragedy, dying young before even getting to fight on the hospital ship. And last but not least, extremely talented. Mm. So, you know, I used to drive people crazy. I used to go to Greece in the summers when I lived in Europe, and every time we'd be sitting at the sunset over the Ouzo, I would recite, "The Isles of Greece, the Isles of Greece, where burning Sappho loved and sung."
That's so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. He's so lyrical and so talented. So I'm saying, is talent a bad boy's attitude? Can we include that? Oh, sorry, attitude, a tribute.
Possibly also an attitude, actually. Yes. Yeah, I think it is, because bad boys, I think they have a great belief in their own talent.
So they have an attitude that they have the attribute of talent. Yeah,
that's right.
And charm, of course, is the other thing. You know, Byron charmed people, and then he walked over them. Well, I don't know actually about his peers and his fellow male poets, but definitely the women he had affairs with. So in our story of the Shelleys, it was poor Claire Claremont who was with them on that famous Frankenstein summer, Mary Shelley's stepsister, who had fallen madly in love with him and was treated so badly by him. After having his child, he took the daughter away to Italy, put the little girl in a convent. Claire kept begging so she could go visit him, her, and he would never let her. And then this little girl died of typhoid. Mm. Claire was off being a governess in Russia.
Terrible.
Yeah, so the mad, bad, and dangerous to know, we all love so much, that was actually said by another of his affairs, which was the fellow aristocrat, Lady Caroline Lamb. So when Byron ended their relationship, which was very visible in aristocratic circles, she, at a society party, she slit her wrist with a broken wine glass. And Byron recounted this as, Lady Caroline performed the dagger scene, you know, referring to Lady Macbeth.
Mm, what an awful, horrible thing to say. Just seems so heartless to me.
Yeah, oh, definitely heartless, but quite funny. She was, I mean, Lady Caroline was a bit over the top. It's actually postulated in that book, Young Romantics, the Daisy Hay book, which I think I recommended when we did the power couples, that the line, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, could apply to Caroline just as much as to Byron. She was a troublesome child. Kind of an old-fashioned word, isn't it?
I like the word troublesome. In fact, I still use it quite a bit.
It's much better than troubled, isn't it?
Yeah,
troublesome. Well, it's actually two really different things, isn't it? Maybe troubled is more internal and troublesome is how you affect the others around you. Mm. So, yeah, they should be used more carefully. There should be more careful distinction between the two. And her family, so in response to her being troublesome, so in other words, affecting the other members of the family, her family gave her laudanum, which was just, you know, opium, when she was growing up. And she also had a special governess.
And I wonder what a special governess was.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of picturing a Mrs. Danvers type with keys clanking on her belt. But anyway, poor Caroline, she was only 42 when she died. Another of those romantics, you know, as the book is called Young Romantics, they never lived to an old age, died from abuse of alcohol and laudanum. So maybe, you know, we should have had However, because I was reading up on her a bit in preparation for Bad Boys, and I'm thinking maybe we should have had Byron and Caroline as a literary power couple, because I didn't know this. After the end of the affair with Byron, she anonymously published a gothic, well, it wasn't very anonymous, everyone knew it was her, a gothic novel full of scathing caricatures of prominent society members, and she was blackballed from fashionable society, a la Truman Capote in New York. And final candle on the cake, the book was dismissed as pulp fiction.
Oh,
an early pulp fiction,
early
even before your lesbian pulp fiction that we thought was so early.
But what a great example of literary revenge.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, speaking of female bad boys, what about Patti Smith? Do you think she could be a bad boy? I think so. She was certainly unorthodox, especially in her music, being part of the New York punk scene. Now, she was raised in the 1950s in working class New Jersey, and she was brought up a Jehovah's Witness, which I didn't realise for the longest time. But she rebelled and she rejected organised religion and conformity in general, as you did probably at that time.
And as she, some did. And,
oh, I suppose as some, yes.
That's
some
the whole
did.
Point why it was conformity,
yeah, <that's,
laughs> isn't it? Yeah.
That's true. So she moved to New York and lived in kind of poverty for a time. Now, she was the girlfriend of Robert Mapplethorpe and lived with him in the famous Chelsea Hotel in the 1970s. I bet that hotel could tell some stories. And she called She described Mapplethorpe as the artist of my life, and I think that's a really beautiful description.
Yeah, she's in her later years, she's become really adept at that very tender, I think a tenderness has come out. I had to laugh a little bit when you said lived in poverty. You did say kind of poverty.
Oh, yeah.
Lived in poverty. It was a bit Dickensian. I mean, she had a job at Strand Bookstore. I think it was, well, she had a number of bookstores. But anyway, I think the one that's in Just Kids is where she talks about the Strand Bookstore, where she used to either dip into the cash register, or did she let her friends buy books and only pretend to bring them up at the cash register, or something like that.
It was something like that, wasn't it?
And I think, was that the store where she met Robert Mapplethorpe, or was it a different store? There was that bonding over the beautiful Persian necklace that was where they recognized their spiritual kindred.
Yeah, it's. I think it was that story, and it's such a beautiful story. I really love Just Kids, and it's hard to believe it's 10 years since it was published.
Yeah, I can kind of believe it, because it's always had a sort of an out of time. You know, you could say to me 20 years, you could say to me 5 years.
Yeah.
It'd be the same. I thought when I was reading it, I loved it too. I read it in like two nights. I think I stayed up all one night reading it. That it's got that really kind of fable sort of touch to it. It's a little bit magical. It's a bit of a fairy tale, isn't it?
Yeah. I sometimes take it away on holiday with me to read. I find it a really something, yeah, it is magical, isn't
it? Yeah, does that to remind you of the important things in life or something?
I think so, yes. Now, and they have recently released the illustrated edition.
I haven't seen
it,
has it?
No, I haven't yet, so I'm really excited about seeing that.
Yeah, I think, I'm going to say, I think on reflection, that Mapplethorpe was the real bad boy. I mean, Patti definitely had the bad boy look.
Yeah, she did, and there's that iconic, it's a, probably a terrible word, album cover of horses from the 70s.
Photo by Robert Mapplethorpe.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the look I always associate with
her. Yeah, definitely a bad boy look. She definitely had the look, but I don't think she really had that recklessness. I think it was part of her performance. You know, like there's a scene, where is it, where she talks about seeing Jim Morrison, is it in Just Kids, where she talks about seeing Jim Morrison perform, or maybe it's in Eileen Miles' book about living in Chelsea, the hotel, Chelsea Hotel, where she comes back away from seeing Jim Morrison, and she talks about it had been really disturbing to her, but it also made her, she doesn't use the word envious, but it's, you can see, you know, it's a quickening of the blood. She recognizes that power of the performance. And Eileen Miles does talk about her, not really a show-off, well, maybe, you know, really liking people to be paying attention to her, really. And she you know, in the, but in her writing, and as she is now, she's so tender and devout and, you know, devout, not to religion, as you said, but to the things she believed in. So not the church, but to, for instance, to her poet idols, Rimbaud and Mayakovsky,
yeah.
Who were definitely bad boys.
Yes. And because Mapplethorpe, the bad boy, he was arrogant and he displayed sort of ruthlessness, I think, didn't he? And certainly traded on his very good looks. And that's a bad boy thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think all in all, Patty was more in love with bad boys than a bad boy herself. What do you think?
I think that, yeah, I think you're right.
There's something so touching about her adoration of these literary bad boys. It's like adolescent crushes. Mm. And I always remember seeing this documentary, having gone through adolescent crushes myself on literary bad boys. But this is the thing about Patti Smith. It's so amazing. She held on to that. Even when she was 20 or 30, she was still talking about Rimbaud. You know, in that same...
Yes, as if she was a teenager.
Yeah. And she never rejected that teenage complete devotion to something, you know. And I always remember this documentary where she goes to see the house of Rimbaud. Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
And she's in this old country house in France, and she's, the camera's following her around, and she goes into the outhouse, and she says in this really hushed voice, "This must be his urinal." Well, I'm not sure. So she doesn't actually say urinal. As I recall, I was quite startled. She gives it a New Jersey pronunciation, I have to think. She calls it the urinal, I think. So how do you say urinal?
Well, it's not my specialist subject, but I think I say urinal.
Urinal. Well, see, that's really interesting, because a British Navy commander chatting with me in England looking at some council houses said to me they look like bloody urinals. So that's the British pronunciation.
It must be my British past.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, I can't think of her as a bad boy when you get hushed by seeing Rimbaud's urinal. Bad boys are never hushed.
No, and rhymes with hush, they have crushes, but they only have crushes on themselves, really, don't they?
Yeah. Well said. It's a really supernatural moment in the movie, but I did have a better appreciation of it when I read Edmund White's biography of Rimbaud. So this is Rimbaud, The Double Life of a Rebel. Catch that.
Yeah.
Where he talks about how Rimbaud used to hide out in the urinal to think in peace.
Now, the images I've seen of Rimbaud, and that there's a famous photo, I believe it's a photo, I always think he looks like, or he reminds me of David Bowie.
No, it's most definitely a photo. There is a oil portrait as well. But definitely a very famous photo. So we're talking mid-19th century, so not Byron period. I never thought of that, but I remember Edmund White talking about the asymmetry. He was very appreciative of this asymmetrical mouth that Rimbaud had. And, of course, David Bowie has the asymmetrical eyes. I guess what made me not compare the two was that Bowie was always so perfectly turned out. Mm. And Rimbaud was quite sloppy and sulky. But, however, you know, when I said double life of a rebel, rebel. So they were definitely both rebel rebels. You know, that line, you want more and you want it fast.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there was a shoplifted book of poetry by Rimbaud that Patty had in her possession for the longest time.
I didn't remember
Someone shoplifted it. I don't know who, but
there could have been many candidates for that,
yeah.
Just as there were probably many people with a shoplifted book of poetry. possibly even myself. No, definitely didn't. I don't think I ever shoplifted books. So Rimbaud was Robert Mapplethorpe of his day. Mm. He was a very talented poet and became famous young. He was 19. He was very sensitive. He was on the make. He was one for fast living. He burned out while still young. And, you know, he was 30. It was before he was 30. He just disappeared off the map. It's always amazing to think he wrote all of his poetry in 5 years. And then, of course, there's this sexual taboo that hovers around his poems. So France, later famous as the place where Oscar Wilde went to hide out in from sodomy charges, but, after having paid his dues to society on the sodomy charges. But, you know, in that time in France, sodomy was crime there too. And, so I'm thinking Paul Verlaine, so this is the older established poet who had the affair with Rimbaud, might have been Rimbaud's Sam Wagstaff.
Ah.
Except, of course, Sam Wagstaff wasn't married, so Robert Mapplethorpe couldn't ruin his marriage the way Rimbaud ruined Verlaine's marriage.
And because I think bad boys are often home wreckers, aren't they?
Definitely, yeah. And so Verlaine walked out on his marriage. He just had a child. His wife had just had a child. He walked out on his marriage and embarked on this mad affair, there's mad again, with Rimbaud, which lasted nearly 2 years, what would you say, strongly lived years. They hung out with the Paris literati and they traveled around Europe, and until at a certain point, a drunk Verlaine, or would you say drunken? A drunken Verlaine, sounds better, shot Rimbaud in the hand.
Oh, that's a bad boy.
With a pistol. Yeah. So Verlaine went to prison and Rimbaud went back to his mother's house and wrote his book of poetry, the book that made him famous, literarily famous, A Season in Hell. It's really incredible to think, so he, you know, wrote this book and then for 20 years never wrote again except for letters, and when he died he was only 47. Ooh. So I guess the French word for literary bad boy would be what they call Rimbaud, so the poet maudit, which means the accursed poet. So usually drunk, often vicious, whining about his misfortunes. Mm. That's the cursed part, is always because not being recognized, insufficiently recognized for talent. That's the accursed part of being a poet maudit. And the only person who couldn't see his faults was Verlaine. And that's, you know, his, as Edmund White says, or the term that Edmund White would use, Verlaine was, you know, the beautiful boy.
Yeah. And, do you know, speaking of beauty and being really good-looking and charismatic and narcissistic, I'm wondering about David Foster Wallace, or as his fans call him, DFW, and DFW always reminds me of an airport in Texas, or a U.S. president that comes from Texas as well.
Oh, or did it come from Texas? Very good point, because I was thinking DFW. I was thinking, is that Dulles? I was trying to get it. I knew.
So
it's Dallas-Fort Worth. DFW.
So
was DFW aware of that?
Probably. So, I don't know. DFW was good-looking, charming. He was a real all-American boy, champion sportsman. I think he was a football player, tennis champion. And he was the son of English teachers. So I think he was probably destined to become a writer and an English professor.
Yeah, I know about this. His mother was the English teacher, and she used to cough ostentatiously when her kids made grammatical mistakes. and then they had these family activities like replacing any mention of the word pie. Maybe this was like while you're driving in a car or something. So replacing every mention of the word pie, or it might have been during dinner. Probably would have been during dinner.
Yeah.
Shades of our old friend Jonathan Safran Foer. So instead of saying pie, you had to say 3.14159.
So you'd have some apple 3.141519 for dessert.
Exactly.
Yes.
I was trying to think of a word that has pie in it. It's quite hard. So, you know, like to use it as a syllable.
I can't think.
Yes. It'll come to us.
Yeah, it will, probably later on. Well, you know, and maybe that's why, because he really did have such an amazing command of language.
But I just thought of it. Sorry.
How
about the 3.14159 Piper?
Oh, yes. Love it.
Yeah. We'll leave that to our listeners too.
And I'm just drawing the Greek symbol
right
in the air at the moment. So he had a really amazing command of language, but I think he knew it and he was pretty much trying to be, well, he knew he was witty and very cutting and scathing. But he was someone to all outward appearances had it all, had everything going for him. And yet he was troubled.
Troubled.
Yeah,
not troublesome.
Yes, well,
oh, actually, both.
Both, actually. Because he suffered from depression and anxiety and addiction. But he had misogyny by the bucket load, actually. He was involved with the writer Mary Carr for a while, and it sounds as though he treated her horribly. There's stories that she tells where he assaulted her and threw her out of a moving car. Just awful. And she always felt that her concerns were never taken seriously because he was a privileged white man. Now, he does, DFW has quite a cult following.
Is that a cult following above all among privileged white men? Probably. Privileged white young men.
Yes,
but
probably.
The question is always, you know, have they actually read Infinite Jest? Because it is famous as being the novel which is most purchased and not finished.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's a very hard read. It's a difficult one. So I can see why people probably don't. They just pretend they've read it. Now, and
we could do a show on what are the books that people pretend to have read.
Oh, that would be fun. Now, and as a teacher, see, this is awful. He had all sorts of really inappropriate relationships with his very young female students. But his fans or the apologists just say things like, look, he was exploring the experience of living so that he could write about it.
This is where
I don't like it.
Yeah, it's where I'd use the famous phrase, well, they would, wouldn't they?
Who said that? I don't know.
I think it was a queen or...
Yes, could have been. Or Prince Philip or someone. So a lot of women, myself included, well, really a lot of people now feel really quite guilty about enjoying his writing. Although someone once famously asked Mary Carr for advice, and this woman said, how can anyone read his books now in good conscience, now that we know what we know about him? And she famously said, and I've got the quote here, oh, just read them. I still read loads of books by folks with deplorable acts in their bios. I've been emboldened to speak out about this by the bravery of my students and the Me Too and the Time's Up movements. And also, DFW abused others and preyed on his students, and I didn't want them to have to hide anymore. So that says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I agree with Mary Carr. So also because I'm a big fan of Mary Carr, not an apologist for her. So she wrote The Liars Club, which was maybe the first of that modern style of confessional, dysfunctional family memoir, which I love. It was the first that I read. Maybe it was the first in absolute, not just the one that I read. But anyway, one of the most famous. And I think my mother gave it to me, which is odd because we did have people in our family who had trouble with the truth, but I'm not sure if that was the reason. But I already didn't like him before that came out, I'm going to say, and it really just confirms it for me, this story, because I always thought he seemed like a show-off. He was always trying to show how smart he was, and this was confirmed to me when I didn't actually read it, I read the New Yorker article which started it off, which was D.T. Max's biography of David Foster Wallace, DFW, sorry. So he has this part about his terrible, he didn't want to show off, but he couldn't help not being a show-off. And I can't remember, so who said, I don't know if it was there, who was it who said that DFW was the one person who managed at the same time to be both a nerd and a dude?
Yeah, that was, someone said that, didn't they? And because he was a jock as well as a nerd, which is quite difficult.
Nerd, jock, and dude. The bio was, just for the record, every love story is a ghost story.
Oh, yes.
A Life of David Foster Wallace. So is that the title of one of his books, right?
Yes, it is. And he had other sort of...
It's a good title.
Yes, he had some good titles, but he was trying to show how clever he was. One that I liked, his essays, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, and Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. But I'm thinking now that DFW was a hideous man. I hate to say it, but...
Well, I'm going to just say I don't think he really fits the bad boy category. Just thinking of that term that I've seen used for him, you know, semi-ironic. So I don't think bad boys are semi-ironic. That's kind of more of a hipster thing, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so. Well, speaking of hipsters... Well, I don't know whether I am speaking of hipsters now, but...
We didn't speak of them, we mentioned them.
Because what about the Beats? They would have been bad boys.
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, so Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know, there's that famous thing of Kerouac's, the only people for me are the mad ones. How does it go? The ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time. There's something in there about also the ones who never yawn, which is, you know, they did do an immense quantity of speed. I was quite surprised when I got old enough to understand that this was their writing was fueled so much, their mania was fueled so much by speed, and how amazing how much they were able to do of it. But they had that recklessness, that bad judgment. Maybe it was necessary to survive the 50s. I mean, it was Mad Men in a different sort of
Mad Men
time
era,
after all,
wasn't it? Yeah, and because Cassidy self-destructed, really, didn't he? Although it wasn't, I guess it wasn't intentional.
Yeah, I mean, they both did. Drugs and alcohol took them down. So it's that goes back to that thing of, you know, is an addiction that kills you and that you can't get free from, is that called intentional or non-intentional? I'd say non-intentional. But definitely it was an intentional lifestyle when they picked it up. So Neil Cassady died. I just always think this just haunts me. You know, stoned on Seacunnel along the railroad tracks in Mexico, dressed only in a t-shirt on a cold, not t-shirt and pants, on a cold night, no sweater.
Just awful.
No Kathmandu hoodie.
No.
Does Kathmandu have hoodies? Whatever they have. No puffer jacket.
Yeah.
And Jack Kerouac died from an esophageal hemorrhage, which came on while he was enjoying a malt whiskey at 11 a.m.
It's a bit early.
In his life. So yeah. This was 1968 and 69, I think, were the years they died, very close to each other. They were only in their 40s. It was the start of an era which would have been happy to see them as grand old men, who, you know, did refer to them as grand old men, but they never actually became the grand old men. But I suppose bad boys can't become old men.
No, and bad boys never seem to, do they?
Yeah, and it's like sadly. William S. Burroughs, you know, when you were saying... you know, the Beats were all bad boys. And I was thinking to myself, William Burroughs was actually not a bad boy because he was always an old man.
Yes.
You know, when he was young, he was like an old man. Or somebody, you see him in the fedora and suit, you know?
Yeah. Because now, the book I love, the Jack Kerouac On the Road, written about the late 50s, I think, wasn't it? And based on his travels with his friends around the USA.
Yeah, well, especially Neil Cassady, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
So Saul Paradise is he himself narrating the book, and Dean Moriarty is the other character. And they did have a strongly homoerotic friendship, and it's beautifully expressed in the book. I also liked Dharma Bums, and really liked Big Sur.
Big Sur is really great.
Yeah.
Do you think with On the Road, that's why he had a bit of trouble getting it published at first, because of the suggestion of homosexuality? There was some resistance from publishers?
I don't think so. I kind of have a feeling that if your mind was that closed on homosexuality, you weren't going to pick it up. It was like those things we've talked about this, you know, about the close friendship, and everybody nowadays is going, didn't they not wonder?
Or the confirmed bachelor.
Yes, exactly. The confirmed bachelor. I think it was more just this new way of writing, you know, it was the run-on and the lack of grammar and the lack of a style, a recognizable style that fit into the canon of literature. But, you know, when it did get published, it immediately took off. Another very much sign of bad boys, isn't it, is that sort of comet rise, you know?
Yes. I keep thinking of Neil Young songs, but, you know, you rise quickly and then burn out.
What's the Neil Young song?
Yes.
Is there a Neil Young song about rising and burning out?
Sing it. Yes. Oh, I would like to. Maybe next time. Yes.
Well, what's the song?
It's better to burn out than to...
What? It's an anthem for bad boys.
Yes. I can't remember what I'm talking about, but
maybe our engineer Richard knows the song. Do you know the Neil...
Oh, better to burn out than to fade away.
Thumbs up to Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, a bit of a bad boy himself.
Yes. Oh, definitely. And do you know, I love that that quote. And nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. I think of Dean Moriarty. I even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. I think of Dean Moriarty. It's beautiful, isn't
Those
it?
Are the beautiful final words of On the Road. That's the very ending. Yeah. Yes, so lovely.
Very moving.
And guess what, Alison? So I'm looking at the clock.
We are nearly at the end of our...
So for the future, we'll be doing Lovable Rogues. Where are they?
Yes, and we're going to do Bad Girls too,
and
aren't
how
we?
About Badass Writers?
Oh, yes, we want to do that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And don't forget, everyone, that on Mondays on the Auckland Library's blog, there's always a recap of the books that we've mentioned in the show. If we spoke so quickly and so charmingly that you forgot to note it down.
You'll see our show notes. Yep. So on that note, haere rā.
Haere rā, ka kite anō. program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day.